This podcast episode has been funded by the People's Postcode Trust. A huge thank you to players of the People's Postcode Lottery for supporting our work. We really appreciate it. Hello, and welcome to another Somewhere For Us podcast, where we champion queer people and their lives here in Scotland. Today, we're not only going to hear from a 21st century historian, author and translator, she's going to tell us about a Scottish lesbian poet who lived some 200 years before Anne Lister, our very own Gentleman Jack, if you will. Ashley Douglas is here to talk about her new book, With My Own Hand, The Secret Life of Marie Maitland, Scotland's 16th century Sappho, published by Headline Press, out on the 16th of July, 2026. Maybe I should have paid more attention in my history class, but they weren't talking about Marie Maitland in 1992. We are going to talk about her today, though. This is Somewhere For Us. Hello, Ashley Douglas.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the Somewhere For Us podcast. You are a historian, translator and author, and you are currently in the throes of preparing for the launch of your new book, With My Own Hand, which I'm really excited to talk to you about today.
I am indeed. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here talking about it today, not least because it means that I'm getting a break from proofreading it for the second time. What nobody prepares you for in writing a book is just how long the process is. I've started referring to the book boomerang. Every time you think you've fired it off to your editor, your publisher, it always comes back to you.
Flings right back at you.
Like, well, the book boomerang is back.
Well, I feel really bad because one of the first things I said to you this morning, Ashley, was like, I found a mistake.
Yeah, and the worst thing was, I immediately was like, that's fine. That's not the proofread version. Don't worry. Like, we'll have caught it. And then the one that you found was actually one that has not yet been caught. So so that was, it was useful in the sense that we've not caught it yet. So yes, I will add that to my list of corrections. And when you read the final version in July and you get to that part on page 151,
well, you won't notice because
people can guess what it was. It's quite a bad one.
You said it was a howler.
I said it was a howler. Yeah, at this point we're mostly finding things like commas that are should be full stops or vice versa, but this was a genuine typo howler, so I'm very glad that you told me it today.
Well, the thing is, Ashley, you've spent so long on this and there is clearly so much love, sweat and tears gone into this book. It's so exciting. I went along to the Out in the Hills Festival in Pitlochry, which was fantastic. Such an amazing potpourri of queer culture and people and fun, all brought together by Alan Cumings' new project as the creative director of the Pitlochry Festival. And so you were there. And it was just amazing to hear you talk about this. And you speak so eloquently about your work and about revealing after four centuries, is it?
Yeah, just
the most,
four
the most incredible facts, for want of a better word,
yeah.
About lesbians, about women who love women in the 16th century. It's absolutely phenomenal. And a lot of people listening to this will be familiar with one or two historical kind of sapphic figures or lesbian figures. But there's something so enterprising about what Marie Maitland has done with the manuscript. And would you like to tell people a little bit about it?
I would love to tell people a bit about Marie Maitland, yeah, and the context we're talking about, because we are talking about 16th century Scotland. This is probably one of the most hostile contexts you could imagine for, I mean, women in general, let alone lesbians. Immediately post-Reformation Scotland, where we have had obviously the abolition of Catholicism in Scotland, the ditching of the Pope, and instead Scotland has adopted one of the most extreme forms of the new religion, a very austere brand of Calvinism. And in this worldview, women are inferior to men in all ways, and sodomy is one of the worst transgressions imaginable. So this is the world in which Marie lives. She's born in the late 1540s. And so she's like a young teenager when the Reformation takes place. And this is the context in which she grows into an adult and falls in love with and pens poetry to another woman. And I'm very fond of saying that Marie Maitland is essentially Scotland's answer to Gentleman Jack. Everyone's probably heard of Anne Lister now, the famous English diarist and lesbian. And she's amazing. Obviously, I'm not dissing Anne Lister at all. She's absolutely amazing and inspirational. But Marie Maitland lived more than two centuries earlier than Anne Lister, and in an even more hostile time. And Anne Lister is famous for her line, you know, I love and only love the fairer sex. But Marie Maitland...
Same.
Yeah, me too. And Marie said, though, more than 200 years earlier, there is more constancy in our sex than ever among men has been. At a time when, as I say, women are thought of as less than men. So it's feminist in the first instance to say, no, women are more constant and superior to men. And then also for that to be in the context of a romantic poem about love between women. It's just doubly radical in that sense. And if you let me tell you and your listeners a wee bit about how Marie came to live quite a unique life in this 16th century Scottish climate. So Marie is not just a sort of amazing trailblazing feminist in many ways, but also a lesbian. She's doubly radical, amazing woman, amazing historical figure. And it was really a twist of fate that allowed her to live this life. Marie is one of four daughters, and she's part of a very significant political family in Scotland at this time, the Maitlands of Lethington. So her father and brothers, the men of her family, absolutely dominate Scottish court and political life. Her father, Sir Richard Maitland of Lethington, is the keeper of the Privy Seal to Mary Queen of Scots, quite a famous figure in Scottish history. One of her brothers, William Maitland, is Mary's secretary. Mm-hmm. And then another brother, John Maitland, he'll later be Chancellor to King James VI of Scotland, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. So her brothers and father are really top dogs at the Scottish court. And then there's the girls, there's the four daughters. Marie Sobery has three sisters, and all of her sisters, her three elder sisters, all we get of them in the records is they come of age, they get married, they bear children. And really, Marie should have been on this path as well. But the twist of fate that changes everything and means that really the twist of fate that means that we're sitting discussing her on this podcast today in modern Scotland is that just as Marie comes of marriageable age in around 1561, her father goes blind. And therefore, instead of preparing for marriage like her three sisters, she becomes her father's secretary, his literary secretary. And this means that for most of her adult life, instead of being wed immediately as she comes of age and then like bearing children and being a wife and running a household and all of that, Marie instead gets to devote herself to an enhanced education, to learning, reading, writing. She obtains great financial autonomy and social autonomy. And it's just these like twists of fates in history, like her father becoming blind is then what put her life on an entirely different path. And this, of course, she was still a woman in 16th century Scotland. She wasn't cutting about Edinburgh like an open lesbian, but this this twist of fate just gave Marie that just wee bit of relative freedom, this wee bit of space that other women of her era and social status could not have hoped for. And it's in this context, as her father's secretary, as an unmarried woman, that she has the time and space to create the manuscript. And this manuscript contains mostly her father's poetry. So her father is also a poet and historian. So Marie essentially creates a manuscript of mostly her father's poetry and some other men's poetry. There's some poems by her brother John, who's also a poet. There's even a poem by James VI, who's also a Scots language poet. But in amidst this manuscript containing the poetry of the male great and good of 16th century Scotland, Marie slips in her own poetry and poetry of the women around her. And this is just so clever. You know, she outwitted the patriarchy.
In issue 22 of the Summer Frost magazine, which is out now, we have a major dyke culture takeover in the magazine. Delighted to hear from dykes aged 25 to 68 to tell us what being a dyke means to them. We get to spend time with Siobhan Fay, the exec producer of the fabulous Rebel Dykes film and founder of International Rebel Dykes Day. Become a member, receive printed copies of Scotland's award-winning LGBTQ plus magazine that we're so very proud of. Get a free gift with every issue. What is not to love? Visit www.somewhereforus.org/shop.
Well, it's very much a family manuscript. It's a presentational manuscript. As I say, that it's mostly, and it has long been perceived as, this is why the anonymous poems, I should say the female-authored poems, the poems by Marie and the women around her, the lesbian poems in this manuscript, are unsigned in the manuscript. They're anonymous. They're completely unsigned. They're obviously by women, but but they're anonymous. And that's that lovely Virginia Woolf quote about, you know, a non who wrote so many poems without signing them was often a woman. This is case in point of anonymous being a woman. And
because it was dangerous to put your name to it?
Yeah, because women were meant to be demure and subordinate. So if they were writing poetry, and I mean, we also have to say most people weren't literate, right? Even the fact of being able to read and write.
I read that in your book, actually, yeah.
Is a big deal. So Maria's of the social elite. So she is able to read and write. Most people couldn't write, including most women couldn't write. And even women who were literate, this is the Renaissance, so education is becoming a bit more fashionable, even for your daughters. But even then, you should just be writing demure devotional poetry. You should not be writing lesbian love poems or you know, poems that challenge gender norms and things like that. You should be writing some nice poems about your religious belief and how devoted you are. And it's just too bold a thing for women to be writing experimental poetry or challenging poetry and attributing it to themselves with the view of wide circulation. This is just not what women do. You have to be, know your place.
At that event that you were presenting at, you talked about the fact that some historians have tried to interpret this as being men penning as female characters in these poems.
Yeah.
And you know what struck me about that? I think you might have said something similar on the day, is that I just can't see men not wanting to take credit for stuff.
Well, completely. Well, this is exactly it, though. You have to question, well, why would a man not put his name to something?
Yeah.
Most of the poems in Marie's manuscript, it contains mostly poems by men and attributed to men. So when a man has authored a poem, she clearly says this, by Sir Richard Maitland of Lethington, by John Maitland, by Alexander Arbuthnot. So where we have evidence for queer people in history, which we absolutely do in this manuscript, this is unequivocally poems by women about love between women. I don't think there's any other way to read it. That's an objective reading. That's not reading it through a queer lens or reading into it, that's literally the objective reading of these poems. But what we've often seen in history is a discomfort to read queer history for what it is. And that, you know, that obviously comes from the world that we live in, where, you know, being gay has been criminalised and condemned until very recently in our history. Mm. We're fortunate that we're sat here in modern Scotland today, where things are, relatively speaking, pretty good for us. We have equal marriage. The listeners can't see Jules's face there. Like I said relatively speaking.
It's true. I'm still hopeful.
You know, on a global scale today, and in terms of other centuries in this country, relatively speaking, things are better for us today.
Agreed.
So in history, evidence of heterosexuality is accepted at face value. Mm. But if something is going to be accepted as queer history, there has to be so much more evidence, and we're still going to challenge it. And all that means is that queer histories are not told, even when there's lots of evidence for them and even when they're there, because we demand such a higher burden, an unattainable burden of proof, and then some. So even when it's like, well, we've got this manuscript written by a woman, Marie's name is on the title page twice, I should say, it's like emblazoned, Marie Maitland, 1586, the year she completed it. She clearly wrote the manuscript. She's compared to Sappho in another poem. I mean, if we're talking about evidence for somebody having been a lesbian, I don't know what more you could ask for. She's literally compared to Sappho. What more do you want? So we've got this manuscript written by Marie Maitland. She's named as the creator of the manuscript in various of the poems. She's literally described as writing this book, this manuscript. She's compared to Sappho. And then there's these lesbian love poems. Of course she's the author of them. That's quite a lot of evidence. They're so romantic and they're so personal. I mean, you've read some of the book and the analysis, like one poem in particular, poem 49, just called that as the 49th poem in the manuscript. And Marie recorded, most of the poems don't have titles. They're not recorded with titles. They're just presented. This poem is about Marie's desire to marry another woman. And it's so pained and it's so emotive, because what's actually happened is the woman has a husband, and we learn that in the poem. And Marie, in the middle of the poem, essentially expresses, you know, I wish that I could be your husband. I wish that I could take his place. This is not abstract. This is very rooted in somebody's lived world and lived reality. And my theory about the occasion of the writing of poem 49, as you'll have read in the book, I'm sharing this theory for the first time in the book, is that it was occasioned by Marie's lover's marriage to a man. So my sense is that Marie and her female lover had an intimate relationship for some time, but that her lover, unlike Marie, had to get married. Marie had a convenient opt-out, but not everyone had a blind father who needed a secretary. Mm. So
she had a job.
Women
didn't have jobs.
Yeah,
she had a job. That was a great excuse.
Otherwise occupied, but for her sisters and for her female lover, it was marriage or marriage, especially because, as I mentioned earlier, we're immediately post-Reformation. So the one other option for women, which was becoming a nun, great route for historical lesbians, had gone. So by the time Marie's getting to marriageable age, it's marriage or marriage. You can't even be a nun anymore. Marie has this great opt-out of blind father, I'll be his secretary. But Marie's lover, it would only have been a matter of time. You know, if they've met in, say, their late teens, the average age for marriage is about 18, and you would certainly be married off by your early 20s. So from the moment these two young women meet and fall in love, there is a clock ticking, because Marie's lover is going to have to be married at some point, and they might have enjoyed a few years of this romance and intimacy, and then she's married off to a man. And my strong sense, having spent a lot of time with this poem and Marie's life and its stanzas, is that that's what occasions Marie to write this poem. It's not a poem just about love in abstract. It's not like, oh, I'm falling in love with you. It's I love you so much. I love you more than anyone else ever could. And it pains me so much that you're married to this man. That's the poem. That's the poem. I should be married to you. And we can, you know, what I find fascinating about poetry, Marie's poetry, and also like the poetry of Sappho, it's so immediate, right? Because these universals, like romantic jealousy and heartbreak and love, like so it's the same stuff. It's the same stuff. So reading poem 49, reading Marie's words, it's just, to me, it just feels, that doesn't sound very academic. There's all the academic proof as well, which we've kind of touched on already.
Yeah,
and you're just on an emotional level.
Outlines that really beautifully.
Yeah, it is of course important as historians that we evidence what we're saying and have proper documentary evidence. But I think it's also important to remember that we are dealing with humans in the past. You can also respond on a human emotional level. Mm-hmm. It's on the one hand, I can say, here's the evidence that Marie wrote this poem, is her name's on the manuscript, it's anonymous, she's compared to Sappho, it aligns with her attested life biography. And also reading that poem as a human, as a feeling human, it just feels real. In a way that, like, this is literally the outpourings of somebody who is in this situation, as opposed to this is a poetic experiment by a man. It just, mm-hmm. It feels like a genuine poem of love. And what I'm also revealing in my book is that it's not the only lesbian love poem in that manuscript. I've been writing about Marie and the poem 49 in particular for a good few years now. But what I'm so excited to reveal in the book is that there are two further lesbian poems. I can't go into the details of these poems because we are recording a couple of months before the book comes out. And
we just had a quick chat about it. Yeah. We decided that it has to be kept a secret.
Yeah, but there are, what I can say is that poem 49, which is the one that I've talked about so far publicly, mm-hmm. is not the only lesbian love poem in the manuscript. And it's a very powerful one, poem 49, but arguably the other two, or certainly one of them, is more beautiful. Because it's a poem of just pure love. Poem 49, as I've touched on, is kind of rooted in heartbreak and pain. So it wouldn't make as good a wedding reading. So it's got this really sad bit in the middle about her having a husband and everything. But there's another one that's just like pure. If I wasn't already married to my wonderful wife, we'd have to have that at our wedding. And I hope other people have it
that's
at their
beautiful.
Wedding. Your
face is completely lit up. Like completely.
Honestly, I'm so excited to share like the other lesbian love poems with people and for people to read them. And I actually got told recently by a friend, it was so exciting, that a lesbian couple got married and they had a reading of poem 49 at their wedding.
Wow.
Which is so cool.
Well, this kind of goes into what I wanted to talk to you about in terms of your feelings about Marie Maitland now, that she's going to be more revealed than she has been. I know she's not a complete secret. You know, there is access to the fact that she's lived, and people can do their own research around that, I guess, and go and find out a little bit of information. But you've been with this for so long now, and you've written this incredible, like it's nonfiction, like it's full of her stories. And, you know, in Summer for Us, we love delving into queer stories and like upholding queer stories and making sure those are archived. That's one of the things I love about a podcast, is that those words are out there and hopefully people can access them all over the world, privately, quietly, however they want to. People's stories are so important, and Marie's story has been yours in some way, and now it's going to become ours.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how you feel about that, because I'm sensing you feel good about it, but it also must mean a little bit of letting go, does it?
I'm mostly just excited for people to learn about this amazing woman. And my research has been based on all original records, many of which have been unseen for centuries. So this is really brand new research, her story told in full for the first time since she lived centuries ago.
That is incredible, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'm glad you've enjoyed the book. Because as you say, there's little bits of information available about Marie so far. She's got like a Wikipedia. There's a wee entry in Oxford Dictionary.
Yeah, I did a little bit of a dive after your event, and yeah, it's limited, isn't it?
You can find small bits, but yeah. So what I've done over the past 5 years is gone looking in the archives, gone looking in the original records from centuries ago. But these are records. They're tomes of ink and paper records written by people centuries ago. They're untranscribed. So what I mean by that is this is literally manuscript records. So the only way to go through them is to go into the National Records of Scotland or the National Library of Scotland and just sit with these pages. You just have to go through them and see what's in them.
For more information on our magazine and podcast, you can visit us at somewherefrost.org or find us on the socials at Somewhere For Us. And if you become a member, you receive printed copies of Scotland's award-winning LGBTQ+ magazine. Visit somewhereforus.org/shop. Your support for our wee community interest company means the world to us. Thank you.
When I started my research into Marie, I didn't know what I was going to find. There might have been nothing. There might have been nothing. But I actually found so much about her.
How long did that take for you to go through the whole manuscript?
Marie's manuscript of poetry?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll explain to listeners a bit more clearly. There's like two separate sources. So so throughout the book, we've got the poetry, which is the manuscript, which is held down in Cambridge now. And then you've got the documentary sources for her life. So these are like my two source materials throughout poetry and then like historical records. So records of things like financial contracts and stuff like that. The manuscript, I did two research trips down to Cambridge and spent several days with the manuscript each time. Because as I mentioned, you can see things like the paper changes. Why does the paper change halfway through? Well, the paper changes twice. And when you're sat with the manuscript, you notice things like that. And you start to think, well, why does the paper change here? And what poems are being recorded at the time that the paper changes? And why is poem one in a different ink to poem 89 or whatever? And then you can start.
And why are there tears on this one?
And why are there tears on this page? Yeah. And why has this line been copied out? So I spent hours and hours with the manuscript, getting really, really intimate with all these, like every single bit of paper. You can see little ink smudges. You know, it's like so human.
Can I just tell you that my coming out letter to my mum when I was 20, so this is back in 2000, I think reached her on a Tuesday and I received hers on the Wednesday, between Scotland and near London where she is. Her letter back to me had tear stains on it.
And I
keep the letter, and it was really supportive, by the way, so it was not a tragic letter, but it's a really beautiful letter of, like, you know, of sort of processing of my words and then sharing her words.
Yeah.
And the thing I cherish about that letter most isn't just the words. It's the paper they were written on and the tears that paper has captured because it's smudged. Where she was crying as she was writing. So that speaks to something about the lived experience of writing and what happens with, what paper you're using.
Yeah, and the physicality of documents. Yeah, and this is the thing with the manuscript. So the manuscript that contains the lesbian love poetry and other female authored poetry, it has always been known about by scholars. People sometimes think that I like discovered the manuscript. I didn't discover the manuscript. The manuscript has been known about since it was written. Marie completed it in 1586 and after it stayed in her family for a wee while, and then it ended up in the private collections of Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist. He's a collector.
Okay.
So he's got a private library that's still part of Magdalen College in Cambridge. That's where it ended up. So there's like only one version of the manuscript, the ink and quill manuscript that Marie created. There's one version of that. And then what we have is a few print editions. So the first print edition was 1786, and then there's another print edition in 1920, and there's another print edition in 2015. And these are the versions that I was first reading and how I first stumbled upon Marie Maitland and her poetry, reading these later print editions. And that's because I'm really a Scots language historian. That's my first academic love, really, is languages. and particularly Scots language, and then particularly the 16th century, because that's a time when Scots was still the language of the Scottish state, parliaments and court. So I was aware of anyone who's a scholar of Scots language history and Scottish history of that era, you're aware of the Maitlands of Lethington, and they're big political players, and you're aware of the Maitland Quarto manuscript, which is what Marie's manuscript is formally called. I call it Marie's manuscript, but it's known among academics as the Maitland Quarto manuscript. Maitland for its connection to the Maitland family, Quarto mm-hmm. because it's just quarter sized pages. So I was like 5 years ago now studying this manuscript as a Scots language historian. I thought I was just looking at a manuscript full of Scots language poetry from that era, which was going to be interesting to me anyway. I knew it contained poems by Sir Richard Maitland. I knew it had one in there by King James VI, who's very interesting to me for various reasons. So this is why I was opening the manuscript, and the version I was looking at was a 1920 edition, which has the title, you'll let you know, the Maitland Quarto Manuscript containing poems by Sir Richard Maitland, Alexander Arbuthnot and others. So I thought that's what I was going to be seeing at this manuscript from the 16th century containing historical Scots poetry by men. And I was quite happy about that. Cool. What I was not expecting, and imagine my surprise, when I opened the manuscript and on the front page is this woman's name, Marie Maitland, twice emblazoned in quite bold scripts, and the date 1586. So I'm immediately thinking, oh,
there's a woman's name.
What's this woman's name on this manuscript? I didn't know that was anything to do with this. And then I was reading through the manuscript poems in this later print edition. This is not me meeting the manuscript in Cambridge. This is a later print edition. And I'm reading through the poems. And yeah, there's all the poems by the men. But then I kept hitting poems with no name at the bottom. Like, who are these by? Anonymous. And of course, by this point, I'm already starting to go, there's more than meets the eye here. And then I hit poem 49, which is the super lesbian poem. By this point, I'm like, what is this?
Number 49, known as the super lesbian poem.
Yeah. So I stumbled up, so, you know, I kind of found poem 49.
It's a stumbling. I think this is fate. I think you were always meant to find it.
Well, this is what happened. And I immediately recognised the significance of that poem. And as I say, this manuscript has long been written about, but as a poem, as a manuscript of poetry by men, there has been some scholarly discussion of poem 49 as a potentially lesbian poem or potentially a poem by a man pretending to be blah, 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 blah. There's been some academic discourse, though, but obviously nothing that's really went mainstream in very scholarly places. And I was immediately like, no, this is really significant and this needs to be shared. Like this can't just be known about by a handful of scholars who specialise in early modern Scottish poetry, which is like three people, do you know? So I was like, this needs to be shared. So the first thing I did, this was February 2021. I wrote a blog for the National Library of Scotland for LGBT History Month in February 2021, taking every opportunity I could from then to share. But at this point, all I really had was poem 49, the lesbian mm-hmm. poem, and the Marie Maitland manuscript. And at the same time, for the past years, as I've been sharing that, the headline points, Marie Maitland was a historical lesbian, this poem 49 is amazing, I was also simultaneously continuing to research the rest of the manuscript. There's 95 poems. Mm-hmm. So I was also deep diving the entire manuscript, and which led to me finding two other lesbian poems that have never been discussed as lesbian poems before.
Can I ask a question? And you might not be able to tell me the answer. Are you going to put these poems in a book?
Yes. Yes, we are. No, I don't think they're in the version that you saw, but
no,
we did.
Because I was scrolling through trying to find all of them.
No, my editor and I did decide at the end, we thought, you know, we should definitely include the three lesbian poems at the end because people will probably want to see them.
I love that you had them at the end, definitely.
Yeah, so they'll be at the end. I was continuing to deep dive the manuscript. And at the same time, obviously, I want to know everything I can about Marie Maitland. I'm like, who is this woman? To me, clearly, she wrote the manuscript, she wrote the lesbian love poems, but who was she and how did she come to do this? So at the same time, I started researching everything I could about her life because you very quickly exhaust the sources that are out there. It's like a few sentences here and there. So I'm like, right, okay, there's nothing much out there about
her. If anyone's
her.
Ever been on Ancestry.com, I mean, if you try and find the women in your, like, finding women's histories generally is so hard.
Yeah, and it gets harder when you go further back. But the good thing about Marie, on the one hand, centuries ago and she's a woman. On the other hand, very, very socially elite woman, part mm-hmm. of a very socially elite family.
So on that note, it's interesting that we, like, I'm thinking about Anne Lister as well.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, just how the only way we know about these women is because they had social standing and because they were part of the elite.
Exactly.
And they had means and access to archiving. Yeah, her diaries were kept.
Yeah.
They weren't, you know, And she was also literate enough to do that. Like,
although they were nearly destroyed when they were first found, and they were yeah, and they their content, by which we mean the explicitly sexual content, was determined. They were nearly burned. They were very nearly burned, and one of the guys was like, "No, we won't burn them. We'll just hide them." So they were hidden away. But we nearly lost Anne Lister's diaries because of homophobia, essentially, because of, we recognise what these contain. Imagine they'd just been burnt. And that's what I always think of as a historian, is think of all the other records of queer history that may have been created but then destroyed.
Yeah.
Or created then lost.
What drives you to write a book like this? This was a huge kind of commitment of your time to bring this Marie's story to light. What's your biggest motivation?
My motivation is so that women who love other women, women like me and my wife and my friends, can see ourselves represented in history. Like, it's not an academic concern for me. It's a very personal project. Of course, I'm an academic historian and I've had to conduct my research with due academic rigor, but it's personal. If we don't see ourselves reflected in the past, we can feel alone or like nobody like us has ever existed before. But by contrast, when we know that people like us have always existed, for me personally, and I know it's the same for other people, it's extremely affirming and validating. There's real strength and inspiration to be had from knowing that people like you have always existed. And I think that's even more the case when the person is like from your actual city. Like, I love knowing about Sappho and Anne Lister and all these other historical lesbians, but with Marie it just hits harder because she literally walked the same streets that I do. I was just walking here through central Edinburgh this morning, and I mean, in the main parts of the city haven't changed that much. You've got the castle at the top of the hill, Holyrood Palace down the bottom, the great volcanic hulk of Arthur Seat and the Crags. Like, Marie would have seen these literal same things. Like, Arthur Seat and the Crags has not changed. She knew Edinburgh Castle to Holyrood Palace. So I find that so affirming and grounding. And I want other people to feel that too. And I think often queer people don't feel that they see themselves in history. It's not a place where they think they are. And what
pains the past is straight, and then the, you know, modern life is queer. But that's not true.
It's not true. And I mean, I've even thought that before. Even as a historian, I studied Scottish history at St Andrews, but I didn't learn anything about Marie Maitland. So you could be forgiven for thinking that there's nobody like you in Scottish history, because, you know, if there had been some amazing lesbian women in 16th century Scotland, surely I would have learned about her by now. So I genuinely thought, well, there just isn't any. And you can understand why. Look, let's be clear. Of course, there are fewer records of queer history than of straight history, because for much of history, queer people were persecuted and criminalised, and then add in illiteracy and all of this. So like, of course, there are fewer records. But what I've come to realise over the past few years through researching Marie and then other aspects of history is that there are actually far more records of queer history than we've been led to believe. They've just not been sought out or shared. So I consider it as my role as a historian, as somebody who knows her way around the records and has training in history. If I don't go and look for these histories, who will? So I'm doing this research. And what drives me to write a book like this is so that queer people can see themselves reflected in their history, because we are there and we've always been there, and then feel validated and inspired. And what's been a real joy, actually, is seeing other people be inspired by it. So Josie Duncan is an amazing folk singer, songwriter. She's also a lesbian. And she came across my work on Marie, just the stuff that's already out there. And she's been inspired to create new music and songs, beautiful new music and songs about Marie and her world that she's performing at Edinburgh Trad Fest on Monday the 4th of May, actually. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that's already happening. But if I hadn't put that historical research out there about Marie, then Josie would never have known she existed.
It's not just a ripple effect, it's a wave. It's bringing our stories to light and then taking them and making them something new. And then they become a different kind of form and format for people to access, you know, because not everybody's going to sit and read a big book. So maybe there's other ways for them to access that story as well.
Yeah.
And that representation. I'm going to make us take a pause. Because I do want to talk to you about what's coming next for you, including your work with Josie Duncan, but also I want to talk to you about your children's book.
Sure.
Oh, hi. Just taking a quick break to let you know about our summer issue of Summer Frost magazine. It's a bumper one. Our time travelling through the decades continues, and we're time hopping back to the 1990s. We have exclusive interviews with Scottish textile artist Noki, Scottish TV icon Gail Porter, and RuPaul's Drag Race star Kate Butch, and so much more queer joy. Follow us on Insta at @somewhere_for_us for all the latest updates. And now back to the episode.
Ashley, is there anything that didn't make it to the book that you're hoping to share in future?
That's an excellent question. Now, the book contains all the information that I have unearthed or was able to unearth for the time being. However, I am aware of other source material out there that almost definitely contains material relevant to Marie Maitland, but that I was denied research access to.
Who by? So who by? Can you name them?
I can't say, unfortunately. And not least as I hope that maybe if the book does well, that I can maybe like sweetly ask them again, maybe for a later edition.
They
could
have
I,
to.
Could I please to. See this? So I don't want to name names or anything. I mean,
okay.
It's private records held privately. This is the thing. Fortunately for most of my research, most of the records I've found about Marie, the records about her life as opposed to the manuscript and the poetry, have been held by public institutions. So the National Records of Scotland, National Library of Scotland. So what is held in private is like letters. Things related specifically to the family. So essentially,
should we read them? I mean, is it a moral thing? Is it like should we know what's written in Marie's private letters?
I mean, that's a whole other different ethical discussion, isn't it? As a historian, but put it this way,
I mean, I want to know
if there was if there were going to have been letters preserved, say, between Marie and her lover, or letters from perhaps some of Marie's family members talking about anything that might be interesting to us. I know where they'd be. I know that a file of documents exists that's literally like private letters of the Maitland family, late 1500s. So if anything relevant exists, it would be in that bundle of documents. But unfortunately, I wasn't able. They're held privately. They're held at a big, fancy, historical private residence somewhere in Scotland. And... they said they did.
There can't be that many of them.
I know. To be honest, anyone with enough knowledge could probably narrow this down. But they said that they couldn't have me to see them in situ because they wouldn't have enough people to supervise. Because when you go and see things as a historian, you are watched like a hawk. It's really weird.
Oh, wow.
It's really weird. When I've been down to see the manuscript,
because you might add your own Cambridge
as well. I don't know. They're just really precious. Or like you might like steal it, like Stone of Destiny, have a Stone of Destiny moment and just like bring them out the manuscript home.
Or just like, you know, rip a piece out. Like, yeah, that's
they're,
mine.
They're just really, really careful about letting researchers.
Well, I can understand that, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't let you see it.
Yeah, so they said they didn't have staff to supervise me if I came to see it and they couldn't bring them to Edinburgh.
I call BS.
Well, look, I'm saying only nice things because I hope they let me look at them in the future. Because another private holder did bring records to Edinburgh for me. That's often what happens is things that are held privately, they call them a TD, a temporary deposit. At the National Records of Scotland. So they give them to National Records of Scotland and they trust them to make sure that you're...
I mean, I trust them.
...looking at the document properly, you know? So another private family did do that for me and I got to see a really cool document related to Marie and her family.
I just feel like this is the beginning, isn't it? It feels like the beginning of something.
Well, that's what I think. And I suppose with the book, like, you could research it forever because nobody has researched Marie's life before. Nobody. So I'm finding all these brand new documents and every one leads to another one. You find one bit of information, you think, oh, well, if that's that, I wonder if something's there. And at a certain point when doing the book, I just had to stop because I knew it had to be published. I knew I had a deadline. It was coming out in summer 2026. So at a certain point, I had to just actually stop researching now.
But what
and
a great place
write.
To be in, because actually, you know, it's not a question of if, it's when the book does well.
Oh, because thank you. I hope so.
I was reading on your Insta this morning, actually, the comments of the pre-read, the kind of feedback you've got from authors. It's incredible.
The endorsements like, the early endorsements are amazing.
You've got to go to Ashley Douglas.Scott. Wait, is that right?
It's my Instagram is @AshDouglasScott.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hop onto Insta and just have a read through of what some of the people are saying about the book. For me, I had the book in my hands as well, and I was a bit like, what a privilege. But there's something also about the queer community getting it and then what it feels like for the queer community in a more kind of, I don't know, sort of broader pop culture way, you know, where people can actually connect with these poems, not necessarily on an academic level, but on
It's both. It's stories, both, it's both, you know, a fantastic piece of Scottish history. And I'm always making this point, like, queer history is history. Yeah. Queer heritage is heritage. So on the one hand, whether you're queer or not, it's just a fascinating historical biography of a woman who lived in 16th century Scotland alongside some of the most fascinating and best known characters of Scottish history. Like, you get Mary, Queen of Scots, John Knox, James VI, Reformation.
Oh, that's a question for you. Just, did Mary, Queen of Scots, meet Marie?
Potentially. We don't have direct evidence of that, but...
But they exist at the same time.
They existed at the same time. Her brother was Mary's secretary. It's not impossible.
Just saying.
There's more of a sense that she met Henry Lord Darnley, who becomes Mary's second husband.
Oh, yeah, of course. Is that the one that was murdered?
He's the one that was murdered, yeah.
Okay.
I had to think, there's so many murders in that period of Scottish history. It's like, yes, he is. Darnley and Rizzio. Lots of murders. Very murky
time. It's a grim time.
But, yeah, Darnley grew up in England, so he travelled back up to Scotland during Mary, Queen of Scots' time, and it is said that he overnighted at Lethington Castle because it's where Marie grew up in East Lothian.
Is that still a place in East Lothian?
Yes. Well, yeah.
Or is it named something else?
It's named something else. It's just beside Haddington. It's just beside the ancient royal borough.
I was there the other day.
Yeah, so wow. of Haddington, and it's now called Lennoxlove. Some later family bought it and renamed it, and they renamed it Lennoxlove for their own reasons.
Lesbian
but I always...
love.
There's an idea. Yeah. Lennoxlove is, I'm afraid it's rooted in a very heterosexual story, but lesbian love is a much better name for it. I just call it Lethington Castle personally. I live in the 16th century, so it's just Lethington Castle.
You now have to tell me who's going to play Marie Maitland in the historical reenactment of this, the TV drama.
Oh, that would be the dream. I don't even want to talk about it in case we jinx it. That would be absolutely amazing. And the person...
You must have thought about it.
I have. I have given a lot of thought to this, and the person who has to play Marie, if there's any dramatisation, which I really, really, really hope there is, that would be the coolest thing. It has to be Erin Dougherty.
She would be
fabulous. She was portrayed Princess Anne amazingly in The Crown, so she could definitely do that, like, noble, upper-class thing.
Yeah.
And she's also queer, and I've literally read that she was saying that she wants to play a queer role. I've read her interviews Erin. Where she was saying, I want to play a queer role. And I was like, this would
goodness.
Be so perfect.
It's so perfect.
So, Erin, if you're listening, if Marie's being
it's
filmed,
awful. It's
it
awful
be...
that we want to, because, I mean, I do love books, and I don't mean to devalue the kind of presence of a book as well, because the fact that we have this book is that, I mean, you know, it's going to be delicious, and you can dive into it, and come July, you can have a copy for yourself, and you will be able to read these poems in all their glory, because Ashley's done such a brilliant job of not only the translation, but giving us all the context, which is really, really important if you're not a historian like me. So I just, the fact that you've done that work is just making it so easy for me to be able to dive into Marie's life and get access to that queer history that I'm so desperate for, like so many people are. However, it is also great to see a good TV show.
I know. Oh, yeah. I love that as well. This is what I see my role as, though, as I am the historian. So I will go and spend the hours in the dusty archives with the old ink and quill documents in historical Scots. I'll find them. I'll transcribe them. I'll share them.
Yeah, I can smell it.
Yeah, I'm putting this out there so that then other people like Josie Duncan and Rona Munro, also the fantastic playwright. I was so privileged to be historical consultant on their recent play, Catherine James V, where Rona put a sapphic romance at the heart of Reformation era Scottish history.
Yes,
absolutely
Rona.
Brilliant play. Yeah, that was great. But Rona found it really useful to have real life historical lesbians just so that they felt a bit more secure in what they were doing. And putting such a story in that period of Scottish history. And Rona said it was almost like, again, a lot of fate, the perfection of timing that we connected, and Rona came across my work on Marie Maitland just as they were writing a lesbian character into this period of Scottish history, and then felt more confident in doing that. So that's what I want to do as a historian, is also support creatives and other people saying, yes, you can do this, take this, run with it.
Tell me about the creative industry. How inclusive has it been for you as a queer author? Is the literally landscape, as I put it in the written question, is that somewhere that you feel comfortable in? Are you being supported in that? I want the answer to be yes.
I'm really happy to say it is a yes, but I think I've just been so lucky. The sapphic goddesses have definitely been smiling down on me because my agent, Carol Clark of Portobello Literary, is a queer woman. So she was the first person to, well, obviously my pitch went to her with the book and she took it on straight away and has championed it from the start and been a fantastic agent who obviously is a queer person. Gets it, and as well as being a fantastic professional literary agent, also really gets it and is so supportive.
That feels really important with this
book.
It's
so important. I would say if there are any aspiring queer authors listening, I think you really do have to make sure you get an agent who really gets it, who really gets what you're doing and will support you when you need support, because obviously there are some hostile forces out there when you're doing queer history and things like that. So you really need somebody who's going to get it and support you when necessary. So, Carol Clark, Portobello Literary, absolutely fantastic. And as if I wasn't already fortunate enough to have Carol as my agent, when it came to a publisher, my editor is a fantastic woman called Holly, who's also a queer woman. She literally has a Sappho tattoo. So you couldn't have made this up. I have. It's like a queer women team, like author, agent, editor. But that's just luck. You know, that's just worked out so wonderfully for me. So,
you know, if you do come across people that, and they don't happen to be queer, it's also about, like, as you say, it's understanding the intricacies and the value of doing, of writing about queer lives and how important that is. Because you and I talked about, you know, you can go into an interview and people might ask you, what's the point of doing queer work? You know, what's the point of focusing on queer lives? Which is such a, it's such a, if you were a queer person talking to another queer person, they just wouldn't ask that.
Exactly.
And I think that's the thing. It's like, if you're going to find people to back you in your, whatever kind of creative journey you're on, you need to have people who don't need to ask that question because they know why you're
exactly.
doing it.
Exactly. You're going to get enough of that from the outside world. So you need to make sure that the team around you get it. And I don't have to explain to my agent or my editor the value of Marie's story. They get it. They're so behind it, which just makes everything else flow.
I love it. Well, I know that the community is going to want to get behind you too, and get out and buy the book. You can pre-order now.
You can indeed.
You can. Comes out on July
the 16th. Yeah.
Moving on to just a bit more broadly before, while I've got you, and then I will let you go because I know you're busy. But you know, Somewhere for Us, the podcast, the magazine, but also us as a team, we are all about championing queer lives. We're all about championing the community, finding out what the community is up to. And it means different things to different people. And so I like to ask my guests, what does queer community mean to you? Where do you find it? And what value do you draw from it today?
That's a lovely question, Jules. And the point that I'm always at pains to make as a historian, though, is that queer history is history and queer heritage is heritage. So really, we should see ourselves reflected and our stories told wherever we go. Marie, for example, is connected to Holyrood Palace. And it was wonderful last year. There's a warden there called Logan who had come across my work on Marie. And then he ensured that Marie Maitland was included as part of Holyrood Palace's, the Royal Palace of Holyrood House. They did their first ever Pride celebrations at the palace last June. And they included Marie Maitland as part of that. So it's,
and that's down to you?
Well, it was down to my work. You know, I've put Marie into
own
the public
it.
Realm. Thank you. Oh, yes. Kind of, yes. But is it, you know, I'm giving
you
people that history. And Logan, who is a warden at Holyrood Palace, has then been empowered to say, wow, that connects to the history of the Royal Palace that I work at, and I want to share that. And then got to do, it was the first time the Holyrood Palace had March Pride Month. Right. Yeah, our history is everywhere. We really do belong.
That's
everywhere.
Great. I love the idea that you can find queer community can be found in unexpected places. But I love what you're saying about queer community being all around you all the time.
Because you can't
here.
Escape it.
Here we are.
Everywhere.
And it's in our lives. It's in your schools. It's in your churches. It's in your palaces. It's everywhere. And, you know, as a mum of a 7-year-old who's discovering the world, it's so brilliant to kind of give him that message that, you know, we are not a niche family. Do you know, we're part of it. This is our community, where you go to school, where I go to work, you know, when we go out and about together as a family, we belong there. That feels really, really important. And that kind of feels like it's linked to what you're saying there.
Yeah, completely. That, you know, you just go into Holyrood Palace to have a look around and there's queer history right there.
Yeah, amazing. Talking of my 7-year-old, your book, The Lass and the Quine.
Yes.
Is that right? Is that how I pronounce
That's
it?
That's correct. Yeah, The Lass and the Quine.
The Lass and the Quine. Can you tell people a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. So published last year. Yeah, this is my kids' book in Scots. Both of my things are connected. They sound like they're really disconnected, but I specialise in like LGBT stuff and Scots language. So Marie Maitland is a lesbian woman from the 16th century who wrote lesbian Scots. Love poetry in Scots, in historical Scots. And then with my other hat on, with my Bairns author hat on, I also am writing inclusive books in the Scots language, because this is at risk of opening up a whole other discussion. It's safe to say that Scots today is not the language of state anymore. Scots kind of peaked in Marie's time. And then we had, among other things, the dominant language in during the Reformation, dominant language of Bibles was English. And then we had the Union of Crowns with James VI in 1603. And then Union of Parliaments in 1707. And long story short, all of these things meant that Scots gradually became displaced by English as the official language of Scotland. So that's just linguistic history in a nutshell. But it means that Scots language today is a bit, can be often maligned and misunderstood.
Right.
And there's not as many published books in Scots language. And so when I last year published The Lass and the Quine, it was the first ever original inclusive, LGBT inclusive book in the Scots language for Bairns, because people do still speak Scots all across the country. People speak Scots. It's still the language of, like, you go around Edinburgh, you're going to hear Scots everywhere, but it's not really often seen written down, and it's not very much valued as a formal language anymore. And that pains me as a historian, because I'm like, but it used to be the language of parliaments and courts, and now people think it's this like bad English. It's so far from the truth. But
yeah.
So my other kind of passion is Scots language. And everything I do really combines my passion for Scots language and LGBT history or LGBT inclusion. That's the connecting thread between everything I do, even though on the surface they seem quite different. So yeah, last year I published The Lass and the Quine in the Scots language for primary school age kids. So it's in rhyming couplets. It starts off, "Ance upon a time, lang lang syne, their yince lived a lass and their yince lived a quine." And listeners will probably know that syne because it's in like auld lang syne, like very historical Scots word, you know, like long, long ago. And I just thought like lang lang syne was a lovely way to like start a fairy tale.
Beautiful.
And then it rhymes with quine. So we did that, and that book's about a lass and a quine, the princess and the quine, and they're very different.
Sorry, for people who don't know, what's a quine?
Just a girl, just a lass.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's Doric. So obviously there's lots of different dialects of Scots language, and Doric is a very rich language, and up there they call girls quines.
Great.
So that's a lovely story if people haven't come across it. It's all in rhyming couplets. There's a friendly bear. It ends with a wedding.
It's not just a bear, it's a bear with a bow tie.
Bear with a bow tie, indeed. And it's just like in many ways it's a classic sort of timeless fairy tale, but the difference is that instead of a prince and a princess getting married at the end, it's a princess and a quine. So
I love it.
That's that. And I'm very excited to say that I'm currently working on a follow-up book, which is going to be The Lad and the Loon. So loon is also from Doric dialect, and it means boy.
And it means boy.
So they have loons and quines. If you're up in the northeast, that's their
Brilliant.
Dialect words for that, loons and quines. And so doing a follow-up like The Lad and the Loon just
great.
Felt entirely natural. And it's great because I'm collaborating, co-authoring that with...
Same illustrator?
Same illustrator, Kate Osmond. Absolutely fantastic illustrator. You've seen
it's
the
beautiful.
Pictures of Lass and the
yeah,
Queen. They're
really
so
beautiful.
Wonderful and evocative. She's a fantastic illustrator. I'm really glad to get to work with her again because it's so much fun, actually. Writing the book, but then handing over the words to Kate. That's where it really comes to life at the illustration. So it'll be great to work with her again. And I'm also working a co-authoring this time with Shane Strachan, who's a fantastic poet and writer. He was the former Scots Screever, like the sort of national poet for Scotland. And he's also a gay man. So when I was going to do this sequel, I thought, you know, it'd be really nice to have a gay male perspective
on
this
there.
One, because this is for the wee boys or families with two dads. And Shane was just so enthusiastic and like couldn't wait to collaborate. And this one is different. Lass and the Quine is very fairy tale-y. We're in like forest, woodland, all of that. This is an outer space. The Lad and the Loon live in outer space, and there's aliens and there's rockets. And we've written the book. We have absolutely drafted the story. It's beautiful. It's really,
you're
I'm
so
really
excited
happy
about
with it.
It.
And Kate is really looking forward to illustrating it. And what's really cool as well is that there's actually quite a lot of queer space history. If we think about like Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, and she was also a lesbian, although of course she didn't actually come out until after
she was depicted
her death.
She was depicted in an American TV series, which I can't remember the name of. So it's pointless mentioning. Anyway.
Yeah, but I think it's sad that, you know, she wasn't able to be out in her lifetime. She was never out during her lifetime, and it was only revealed that she had a long-term female partner after she died. So how far we've come that now we're going to be writing this explicitly gay book set in space. It feels like a nice bit of reclaiming.
Yeah, so good. I've just been talking with the head teacher at my kids' school and looking at what we're going to do for Pride in June. And she's so supportive, and we're going to have some bunting, but some explanation about why the bunting's there and what it helps people to feel like during June, but also beyond. And we're also talking about having a table of books. Us talking about this stuff at a primary level feels so, so important, because I was once in primary. Me being a seven-year-old, or just a, you know, a young primary age kid, reading that kind of story would have changed the trajectory of my teenage years.
Yeah.
You know, it would have changed the way I built my sense of self, and I would have hidden less, which is just brilliant.
Oh, completely. I dedicated The Lass and the Quine to my younger self, or in Scots, to my younger self, because that's like adults that are doing this sort of inclusion stuff. It's all for our younger selves, isn't it? You're essentially doing the stuff now that really needed when you were wee. I feel more comfortable, more confident in my identity as a lesbian woman than I ever have. And a lot of that is through research and somebody like Marie Maitland, and knowing for sure, wow, women like me have literally always existed, even centuries ago in my own city. I really do take a lot of comfort and validation from history and knowing that people in the past, people like me, have existed. So that's like quite a nice outcome of having done all this research into Marie and told her story, is like I myself, as a modern lesbian Scottish woman, feel more comfortable and confident in that than ever before, and I think than I ever would have if I hadn't come across like a Scottish lesbian.
It is really lovely to have it here in Scotland.
Yeah, Marie walked the same streets I do in Edinburgh. Yeah. Like literally the same streets.
And listener too. I mean, like,
and Anne Lister did also visit Edinburgh. Right. That further makes the point. When I first found out, I think through a Somewhere for Us feature, that Anne Lister had visited Edinburgh, she felt more real to me. As soon as you know somebody's been in your own city and seen the same thing, they just feel more real and you feel more connected to them.
Shout out to Steph Lauer, who is a tour guide who did the Anne Lister tour of Edinburgh, where you can walk around Edinburgh and follow Anne Lister's steps. And she was absolutely brilliant at it, because not only did you get Edinburgh history, like the city's history, but you got it through a queer lens. And it felt so validating, and it feels very similar to how I feel about your book, which is that we see ourselves, we get to connect with ourselves four centuries ago, but also today. Thank you so much, Ashley Douglas. You're a marvel, and I feel so excited for you. How can people connect with you in the coming months? Where can they see you? Where can they find out about your work?
Sure. So people can follow me on Instagram at Ash Douglas Scott, and I'll put all my events and any updates about the book there. And people should also check out Josie Duncan on Instagram, because she is that amazing singer-songwriter doing original songs and music inspired by Marie Maitland. So she's also will be recording an album of that music as well. So keep an eye on her stuff. Myself, I have a good few events lined up across Scotland already and more to be announced. So I'll put them on my Instagram in due course. But I will be celebrating the launch of my book with Lighthouse Books in Edinburgh in July. So you can follow their channels for info on that and when tickets go up. I will also be at the Book Nook, an independent bookshop in Stirling, on the 24th of July. Night Owl Bookshop in Dunbar on the 10th of September, which is really cool because Marie is very rooted in East Lothian.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to be doing an East Lothian event. And I know that I'm also going to be at the Wigton Book Festival in October. Details to be confirmed. So if you keep an eye on Wigton Book Festival. And there are various other interviews and podcasts lined up, like the one I'm doing today. So just keep an eye on my Instagram and I'll be sharing everything I'm doing there, because it's just fantastic to have such support and interest from everyone. So thank you so much, Jules, for being part of that and having me along.
It's brilliant.
To chat.
It's absolutely brilliant to have you part of the Somewhere for Us podcast. Thank you so much, Ashley Douglas.
A pleasure, Jules. Thank you.
When queer history is brought into the light, it feels like somehow it paves the way forward. With huge thanks to historian, author and translator Ashley Douglas for all of the revelations both now and yet to come. Ashley's book is available from July 16th, 2026, and it's called With My Own Hand, The Secret Life of Marie Maitland, Scotland's 16th Century Sappho. Thank you for listening. This is Somewhere for Us.